Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. Now, this is a jam-packed episode. We have two guests, Commissioner Clyburn from the FCC and Lee Petro, leading expert on issues of communication and mass incarceration, here to talk to us. Also, have Clint Smith joining us to talk the news. I want to remind you that you have to find your work, that there's a role for everybody to play and everybody doesn't have to play the same role, that there's a role for social workers, for teachers, for high schoolers, for everybody in this work. So make sure you're finding your work to do and not necessarily just doing the work that other people are doing. Like, you have skills and abilities that are unique to you that aid you in the fight. Now, the second thing I'll say is a dedication. So I'll dedicate this pod to two people. One is Charlena Lyles, who's mother of four, a black woman who was recently killed by the police in Seattle. They said she was wielding a knife. We're reminded that she called the police actually to report a burglary and was killed by the police. She was promised by the police, and it was on camera, that they would not hurt her, and nonetheless they killed her. And the second person this podcast is dedicated to is Philando Castile. You, like I, probably saw Philando Castile's final moments as his girlfriend streamed the aftermath of him being shot in Minnesota on Facebook Live with the young child in the back. The officer who killed him was found innocent on all counts. Now, dedicate this pod to both of them. I'll close out the opening by sharing the words of Philando Castile's mother, Valerie Castile, after she learned of the verdict. I want you to hear this.
My son would never jeopardize anyone else's life by trying to pull a gun on an officer and the gun was not fire ready. These are some of the facts that came out in the trial, and I am so very, 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 very disappointed in the system here in the state of Minnesota, because nowhere in the world do you die from being honest and telling the truth. Now, these are some things that you need to know and recognize. There has always been a systemic problem in the state of Minnesota, and me thinking with my common sense that we would get justice in this case, but nevertheless, it never seems to fail us. The system continues to fail black people, and they will continue to fail you all. Like I said, because this happened with Philando, when they get done with us, they're coming from you, for you, for you, and all your interracial children. Y'all are next, and you'll be standing up here fighting for justice just as well as I am. I am so disappointed in the state of Minnesota. My son loved this state. He had one tattoo on his body, and it was of the Twin Cities, the state of Minnesota with TC on it. My son loved this city, and this city killed my son, and the murderer gets away. Are you kidding me right now? We're not evolving as a civilization. We're devolving. We have taken steps forward. People have died for us to have these rights, and now we're devolving. We're going back down to 1969. Damn! What is it gonna take? I'm mad as hell right now. Yes, I am. My firstborn one son died here in Minnesota. Under the circumstances, just because he was a police officer, that makes it okay. Oh, now they got free reign. He's found innocent on all counts. He shot into a car with no regard to human life, and that's okay. Thank you, Minnesota. Thank you, Minnesota. That's all I have to say.
So I invited Andy Slavitt to come back on the pod. He ran Obamacare for the past 3 years, and he's going to give us an update on what's happening with the repeal of Obamacare right now. Okay, so Andy, thanks for joining for a quick update on Obamacare. What's going on since the last time we spoke?
Well, since the last time we spoke, the bill that was being voted on in the House is now over in the Senate. The bill is being doctored up in relative secret. In fact, there's only 13 people in the country, all of them Republican male senators, that actually know what's in the bill. And it's being prepared for a vote next week. That vote will come only a day or two after It gets a formal CBO score and evaluation. And apparently it looks like it will happen with only a few hours of debate, maybe only 2 or 3 hours of debate. So there could be a vote as early as Thursday of this coming week.
Now, what did we learn about the bill from the last time that the CBO scored it, the House version? Because when we first spoke, there was no score then. What, did we learn anything new?
We did. We learned, I think, four major things. The first thing we learned is that 23 million people across the country will lose insurance coverage over the next few years. The second thing we learned is that the price of insurance for those who still buy it is going to spike. It'll be an average 20% higher. But what's even more interesting is who will pay more and who will pay less. People who are older and who are sicker will pay more. So people who are in their 50s and 60s could pay $8,000, $10,000, or even $14,000 more. And people who are young and healthy could pay less. The third thing we learned is that the protections that people have in the ACA against pre-existing condition discrimination, lifetime caps, and having essential benefits, those protections will disappear, and that'll affect about one out of every six Americans. And then finally, the fourth thing we learned is that there will be, I know we talked last time a lot about Medicaid, there will be a cut to Medicaid that'll be close to $1 trillion. So about 25% of the program will be cut. And that's the care, of course, we talked about that goes to low-income people, kids, seniors, and people with disabilities.
That $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid, is that being offset for tax cuts to the rich, or did I read that wrong?
No, Dre, you got it exactly right. The reason for the cuts is to create a very targeted tax cut. Tax cut primarily affects a couple of groups. It affects people who have over $1 million in income. Those people will have an average of a $55,000 tax break. And then it affects a few corporations, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies, and tanning salons will all see pretty significant tax breaks.
Tanning salons?
Why not tanning salons?
That's just so random that that's going to be included in the...
I'll explain why. Tanning salons have a current tax on them because they're known to cause cancer. And so that is a cut that the tanning salon industry has lobbied repeatedly to have removed. And that's what would be granted by the Congress in this bill.
That's so wild. And in the secret version, do we know yet if the Congress people themselves and their staff are going to retain Obamacare as we know it today, or we just don't know anything yet?
We don't know because it's a secret, but what we have no reason to believe that they will be able, that they will be on the same plan as everybody else. Right now, as you know, they have exempted themselves in the House bill from being on this bill, and it's unclear what will happen. And while very little is known about this bill, what the few details that are leaking out have so far shown the bill is getting worse, not better.
And what can people do about it?
Well, look, if you live right now, this is all coming down to the decisions of a handful of senators. And so if you live in a state with a Republican senator, I think it's very important that Republican senator hear from you. Now, if you live in a state with two Democratic senators, but you happen to have a Republican governor, I think it's important that Republican governor hear from you. And if you live in a state with all Democratic senators and governors, then I think you want to send a message to the Democratic senators to make sure that they are doing nothing in the Senate, if not bringing up the issues around health care and health care reform, no matter what kind of questions they're asked, no matter what the business is, because if there's going to be a secretive process for the consideration of the bill, then they're just going to have to force as much dialogue as possible and call as much attention to it as possible.
Perfect. Thanks, Andy, for coming on to give us an update. And I'm sure we'll have you back on the pod to keep people informed.
Thanks again for having me on, DeRay.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. And now for the news, it's me, Sam Sinyangwe, an incredible data scientist. He's at Sam Sway on Twitter. And then Clint Smith, the third. Clint Smith is a writer, a PhD student, an incredible thinker about race, justice, equity, and education. He is Clint Smith, the third on Twitter. Here we go. Today we have Clint, who is joining us. Clint, it's so great to have you on Pod Save the People.
Good to be here. I'm like Pod Save the People's play cousin, so it's cool to finally come over to the house.
And you just had a baby. How old's the baby?
I did. I had just had a baby. He is 3 weeks old. You know, he is lovely and adorable, and you know, has quickly trained me in all things dirty diapers and not sleeping between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. But he's the best thing in the world, and I feel very lucky.
And what's his name?
His name is, we'll call him Lil J.
Lil J, secret name. Okay, I like that. I like that.
Lil J.
And Sam's here too. Brittany sends her love to everybody. She is not on this episode because she is speaking right now, giving a bomb speech about justice and equity in New York City. So Sam, we'll start with you with the news.
Cool. So my first piece of news is an article that just came out a couple days ago that New York City has decided to divest from private prisons. So like their pension funds had been invested in part in the many different companies that are running private prisons, and the board of trustees that decides how those investments are made decided they were going to pull out all of their investments in private prisons.
That's incredible. How soon will they do it?
I'm not sure how soon. They made the vote, so the decision has been made. I don't know what the timeline is for doing it. What's interesting about it in part is that what I didn't know is that police, New York City police officers, their pensions were actually in part invested in private prisons. So that was sort of some underlying subtext to the article that that was quite interesting.
I was just saying, it's cool to see them take this step. I mean, we know this is something that a lot of schools and universities have been pushed by so many of their students to do. Columbia University, I think a year or two ago, divested from anything in their sort of endowment portfolio having to do with private prisons, which makes sense. I mean, as we know, you know, private prisons operate under the pretense of housing as many people as possible for as cheaply as possible for as long as possible, which kind of runs counter to any notion of rehabilitation or restorative justice. So I think it's important that institutions and cities are really sort of taking a step back and looking at in what ways they want to sort of reject being complicit in the sort of perpetuation and obviously in the Trump era, the potential amplification of a system that operates in such a perverse way.
And we know that the way that we spend our money and the way we use public dollars influences the way industry is set up. And hopefully this will be a model for cities across the country. And like you said, Clint, we also know that like it's not just cities, right? That it's universities, it's businesses, that there are a lot of people who low-key invest in things that are really damaging for communities. And it seems like they're slowly coming around. So this is good news. Sam, what else?
So my second piece of news is that the Hawaii legislature, the state legislature, unanimously approved a bill to create a study committee that is going to look into the state creating called universal basic income, which means that every resident of Hawaii would receive a check, some sort of a basic level of income, regardless of any other factors, just to support themselves, given the fact that, you know, industry and high-paying jobs are hard to come by in the Hawaiian economy, which is tourist-driven.
That's really interesting to hear that Hawaii is taking that step. I mean, since we were just talking about private prison, one thing that's interesting about universal basic income is that it has potentially really huge implications for mass incarceration, right? And so what we know is that so often, in part, what creates the sort of funnel of people going into jails and prisons is systems of poverty and systems of desperation, specifically in Black and Brown communities. And oftentimes people who've been taken out of or discriminated against or sort of removed from the quote unquote legal infrastructure of the economy. And so they go into the illicit market and the sort of underground market drugs and different things and whatnot. But oftentimes, again, people are going into those spaces because they've been purposely pushed out of the, again, quote unquote, legitimate market. And so part of what universal basic income does is potentially creates a scenario in which people are not forced to act with the sort of desperation that might lead somebody to doing criminal activities, which could have potentially huge effects in terms of like who's putting themselves in situations that would ultimately lead them to becoming incarcerated. And so obviously the ramifications and implications of that would be far reaching in terms of not having as many people separated from their families and everything that comes with that.
It's important to note that this is almost always talked about in the context of technology, literally just taking people's jobs away from them. So what happens when there's a workforce that no longer can do the work that they've been doing, but people still need to eat, right? People still need homes. And when we think about the work of equity, this is one of the things that can be about equity. And Clint, to your push, and Clint, we haven't talked about this before, but I thought that there was an interesting critique of universal basic income with regard to race. Clint or Sam, I don't know. I felt like I read something recently. I don't remember it. Do either one of you know what I'm talking about?
I'm sure there is. I mean, I think universal basic income has its pluses and its minuses as anything. I know Tommy Shelby, who's a professor at Harvard and a philosopher, he's written a piece for the Boston Review a few months ago talking about how universal basic income, if implemented properly, is a real opportunity for racial justice, and goes back and talks about, you know, how Dr. King back in the 60s was talking about the Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged. And in that was talking about this sort of inextricable link between racial justice and economic justice, and advocated specifically for a universal basic income because he saw the sort of beginning and nascent stages of globalization and automation and those jobs that so many Black folks who had gone up to the North during the Great Migration were starting to lose because those jobs were being sent elsewhere. So I think, you know, as with any public policy measure, it depends on how it's implemented. But I think if implemented correctly, it can be a huge opportunity. It's not a cure-all, certainly, but if done correctly, I think can be a huge thing for racial justice.
Yeah, so in terms of critiques of it, I think the only thing that I've seen is that, you know, it isn't a panacea, right? Like with anything, universal basic income can help close the income gap, but will not close the wealth gap, right? And the wealth gap is so much bigger than the income gap. It's about $130,000 difference between the average Black family and white family. And so what this policy will do is help to lessen the expansion of that gap, but will not actually, you know, result in Black families getting more money or being compensated to help close that gap between families.
And Sam, what's the difference between income and wealth?
So income is how much money you're making, like in your job. Wealth is the total amount of resources that you have. So, you know, whether it's your car, if you own stocks and bonds, if you own a house, the sum total of all of those things is the amount of wealth that you have.
I think Sam's point is well taken. I think understanding universal basic income as a set of reparations is probably mistaken. You know, it's not going to go back and make it so that Black people had access to Social Security or could get housing mortgages during the New Deal or anything like that. So it can't go and rewrite history. But what we can do, as Sam alluded to, is address the income gap, which creates the sort of basis of a lifestyle in which the sort of larger intergenerational wealth gap can be addressed after that.
Got it. Clint, what's your news?
Yeah, so my first piece of news is not a piece of news per se. So there was a study done in 2014 by two Stanford researchers that I've been thinking a lot about after the verdict came out for Philando Castile. And it talks about the way, you know, if you're like me and you're like us, oftentimes what we're thinking about and what we're talking about is the sort of vast racial disparities that exist in the criminal justice system, whether in arrests or sentencing or what have you. And so part of what we do is we throw out statistics and we throw out data as a means to sort of convince people that there is an issue and that there is a problem. And what this study is discussing is that that actually might have a counterproductive effect and might not have necessarily have the impact that we intended to. So what the researchers did was they took different participants of all white folks, and they essentially, in the first experiment, did an experiment in which they said that there was a white female researcher and 62 white people. They had them watch a video that contained mugshots of different men in prison. And in one of those videos, 25% of the mugshots were those black men. And in another video, the percentage of black male mugshots was raised to 45%. And after they watched the video, participants were asked if they wanted to sign a petition easing up on the severity of California's three strikes law. And what they found was that more than half of the people who saw fewer black male mugshots signed the petition, while only 27% of those who saw the higher percentage of black male mugshots did. Then they did it again in New York City just to make sure. And what they found was that they primed participants by having them read about either the national incarceration rate, which was 40% black, or the New York City rate, which was 60% black. And then they were asked if they wanted to sign a petition to end New York City stop and frisk, which we all know was ruled unconstitutional by a federal judge a few years ago. And again, the results were pretty clear that 33% of those who saw lower rates of black incarceration agreed to sign the petition, while only 12% of those who saw higher rates agreed to do so. And so all of this is to say, you know, when I was thinking about this with Rolando Castile, because so one of the numbers that kept going around was that he was pulled over 46 times during his life before he was killed by the policeman. And part of what's interesting to think about is that when we throw this number around, for many of us, it seems really appalling and it seems really shocking. But for a lot of white folks, that number might only sort of reinforce and reify an idea of his criminality. And folks like Khalil Muhammad and Elizabeth Hinton have written a lot about this, the way criminality and blackness are sort of inextricably linked in the collective sort of imagination of white Americans. And so this was a disconcerting study, but I think an important one to consider as we think about ways to do this work.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. You know, as somebody who often refers to the statistics and the data around some of these issues, I think it is one of these, you have to be really strategic about how you use those numbers. And I think what that study points to is how the audience, oftentimes, you have to be able to anticipate how your audience will respond or react to those disparities. And I think, you know, that really changes depending on who your audience is. I've noticed, for example, with policymakers, you know, they're always looking for the data and the numbers, and they very often dismiss individual cases or stories. And so the data can be a really powerful tool in terms of helping to push along policy change. But again, to the broader public, the broader audience, I think what the study raises is that there are often limits and even downsides to using particular statistics at particular times, and that we have to be conscious about how effective we're being in our advocacy.
And like you said, Clint, the reality that blackness, even for progressive people, still has a negative connotation, right? That like people, the bias runs so deep. And then the question becomes, I think for us as organizers, right? Like how do we call that bias to the surface so we can actually undo it? Because the study doesn't mean this is the way that it always has to be, right? It says that this is the way that it is now, but there is this sort of tension about like, when we talk about the numbers, which are real, and for some people, without the numbers, they just tune out. But the numbers might actually have the adverse effect, which to me is like a conversation about how deep the bias runs, right?
No, I think exactly. And I think it's important, you know, we can look at the Close Rikers initiative and the organizers who were doing that as an example. And I think part of what made that initiative successful ultimately was that it relied in part on stories, right? It wasn't only data. It didn't reject data and say we're not going to use that at all, or not going to use statistics. But really, the story of Khalif Browder was kind of a watershed moment and really gave momentum to the cause. It gave a human face to so much of the chaos and the abhorrent conditions that exist in Rikers, to and brought it to the broader public. And I think that, you know, focusing on those stories is a really important aspect. And not only having the statistics by themselves, again, not rejecting them, but coupling them with compelling and important stories that sort of serve as a microcosm for a much larger phenomenon that's happening.
Boom. And what's your second piece of news?
So a second piece of news, again, isn't new a news story necessarily, but we are recording this on Juneteenth. And I think it's really important to, you know, I always go back and sort of reflect on the enslavement of my ancestors on oftentimes, but especially on this day. And there's a website called informationwanted.org that I stumbled across a few months ago. And on it, it had sort of these ads that were placed by formerly incarcerated folks after the Civil War ended in 1865, who were looking for their family members. And so oftentimes we sort of just universally celebrate emancipation, or we universally celebrate the end of the Civil War, and we say everybody was free. This was great. What an important day, even Juneteenth, when we commemorate that. But part of what I think is important to remember is that freedom was accompanied by so much grief. And there were millions of people who were separated from their loved ones and never saw them again. And I think reading these ads of the sort of heartache and the grief and the devastation that accompanied what should otherwise, you know, presumably be an incredible moment in your life, that you are free for the first time ever without, you know, not knowing that you ever would have been, is bittersweet for many people, because they were taken away from their husbands and their wives and their children, and their fictive kin. And I think that's really important to remember, and to sort of complicate our understanding of emancipation, and that while it was a hugely important thing, it was accompanied by a lot of difficulty for many people.
That's fascinating. I had never seen the site informationwanted.org before. And it's heavy, because you go and it's like all these ads where people are trying to reconnect, and you can actually sign up to help transcribe them, which is also fascinating. This is what's so powerful about this, is that it reminds you, like you just said, Clint, of like the human aspect, that like, and it complicates this notion of what freedom is, right? Like, how free are you when all the people you love and everybody that meant the world to you is like spread across the country, and you are putting newspaper ads out to try and find them? That doesn't seem like much freedom to me.
No, I think you're exactly right.
It also makes me think about the sort of trajectory of history thereafter, right? And how, you know, emancipation was followed by, you know, this brief period of reconstruction for not even really two decades, where, you know, there was sort of an effort to rebuild and reconnect and reinvest in, you know, what could have been an incredible, you know, future for Black people in this country. And then that was all shut down so quickly with the end of Reconstruction and the imposition of Jim Crow.
And even the way we remember Reconstruction, I think, you know, needs to be pushed, because oftentimes, you know, what I was taught is that Reconstruction failed, and that Reconstruction failed in part because of the carpetbaggers from the North and the lazy Black people who didn't know how to be effective politicians. And we don't think about it as something that instead was killed by the sort of creation of the White Citizens Council and the Ku Klux Klan, and these people whose specific intention was in preventing Black people from effectively exercising their citizenship. And I think, you know, Eric Foner and other historians have really sort of tried to flip that narrative on its head and make sure that we understand that it was a proactive thing that was done to Black people and done to the South, rather than the result of something, you know, that has to do with the laziness of formerly enslaved people or anything like that.
Clint, that website's crazy.
Yeah, it's bananas.
How'd you find it?
This PhD student at Penn posted it, and I came across it, I think, a few months ago, and just got like lost in there for hours. It was terrible, but super illuminating. And so, yeah, I just went back there today, and it's just crazy to read it, you know?
So because this is a jam-packed episode, I'm only going to offer one piece of news, and that is that the Department of Education has said that it's going to scale back civil rights investigation. So the details are that regional offices will no longer be required to alert department officials in D.C. of all highly sensitive complaints on issues such as disproportionate disciplining of minority students and mishandling of sexual assaults on college campuses, and that the requirements that investigators broaden their inquiries to identify systemic issues and whole classes of victims will be severely scaled back. So what we see is the Department of Education just wholesale abdicating its responsibility to protect the most vulnerable learners. It is these sort of scaling backs that put our kids at risk. We know that the federal government, even in its faults, has been the only real source of equity and justice in many parts of the country, that when left to states, that they just have not fulfilled that burden. And the Department of Education has done incredible work over the years of making sure that equity is present in classrooms. Clint was a teacher. I was a teacher. Brittany was a teacher. This is this is close to our hearts, and this is really tragic that it's happening so soon and at all.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I've been in many situations where, you know, I've talked to folks who are high schoolers, students or college students, and oftentimes in those conversations, particularly around the election, you know, this question came up of, you know, it doesn't matter if Trump's the president because, you know, all the candidates are bad and it's not going to impact my life. And I think, you know, there are so many facets to how this administration is targeting folks of color, including high schoolers, including college students, by leaving folks exposed to discrimination and oppression and all of these issues. And, you know, when you think about the election, like that was never really a part of the national conversation about the election. It completely went under the radar. And a lot of people may not have been thinking about the role of the federal government in enforcing civil rights standards in schools and in colleges. And yet, you know, that is where so many people find themselves now exposed to what this administration is doing.
Yeah, and I think even as DeRay mentioned, the federal government and the Department of Education has played a huge role in the last, you know, 10, 15 years of even illuminating the disparities that exist in public education. And we can go back and forth about the positives and the negatives of, you know, the language of the quote unquote achievement gap, what that means, or what it suggests about Black children or brown children as compared to their white counterparts, because oftentimes the problem is that the achievement gap is discussed in the context of race without any historical context, without any conversations about what Sam discussed with regard to the wealth gap and the implications that has. But to see those numbers and to see the disparities, I think was important. And while people have a range of different opinions on the best way to move forward, I think it changed the conversation because there was a sort of renewed sense of urgency around what was an ever sort of stratifying divide between Black and brown students and their white affluent counterparts. And those graphs and the data and the statistics were, those were projects that were done by the federal government. Without them, I don't think we would know as much as we do about the disparities that exist racially or based on socioeconomic income across the country.
Yeah, and you're right. During the election, there were so many people who were like, there's this idea that like all politics is local. And I think that sounds cool. I think that all organizing probably is local. But the reality is that the federal government, national politics has a huge bearing on people's everyday lives in ways that they are starting to see now just because this administration's so wild. But this is one where, like, you know, I can think about a handful of school systems that if it was not for the education department, civil rights division coming in and saying, like, you know, you can't suspend kindergartners like that, right? Like, or you can't impact kids of color in this disproportionate way with regard to discipline. Like, they never ever would have been put on notice that they need to change. And it's these sort of things that we have to be mindful of at the federal level. That's the news.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
And now we have Commissioner Mingyang Clyburn, who is a member of the FCC, the first Black woman ever appointed to the FCC. Here we go. Commissioner Clyburn, it's an honor to have you on Pod Save the People this week.
It is my pleasure.
Now, can you talk a little bit about how you got to the FCC and what is it like to be a commissioner? I know that you were the acting chair of the commission for a bit. What has it been like?
It has been an interesting ride. I have seen so many changes over nearly 8 years. I came from the State Commission. I spent 11 years on the Public Service Commission in South Carolina. Before that, I had a weekly newspaper for about 14 years. So I got this gray hair, honestly. But I have been a part of this media and telecommunications or communications ecosystem for some time now, most of my professional life. I believe that people have a need to be informed. And I also know that there are a lot of media outlets out there, but they're not serving people on the ground. And so it was important to me to have that weekly newspaper to bridge that information gap. It was important to me to be a regulator, to take care of that and look at that side of the equation, because what I see too often is everyday people don't see where they have a place, they don't have a voice, that they don't have an advocate. And I consider that myself that advocate for those who can't afford to come to D.C., to those who could not afford to come to the meetings in South Carolina, that I was their voice.
Now, we'll talk about calls from prison in a second, but what else, what does the FCC do that we don't know about? Like, what is the work of the FCC?
The FCC literally has some type of regulatory footprint when it comes to everything that transmits a signal, when it comes to international communications, local or communications within the U.S., when it comes to radio, television, cell phone, satellite, cable, you know, you name it, you know, radio, you name it. The FCC, when it comes to the communication space, we have something to do with that. So I think people don't realize how expanded. It's just not issuing a fine if there's a wardrobe malfunction or someone says something on the air. It is really much more. And when you hear this talk about open internet principles and policies, when we talk about how your relationship with your cellular, your phone provider, when we talk about what goes on cable, satellite, you know, television, we have limited influence on that, but all in all, when it comes to when it's a transmission of a signal, the FCC has some authority somewhere along that plane.
Now, what are the big issues that are before the commission, or what are the issues that people should know about that maybe we haven't been talking about? I think about things like calls from prison, net neutrality. What's on the horizon?
Well, one thing that we are struggling with that people complain about every day, which is our number one complaint that we get at the FCC, is those robocalls. You get them no matter where you are. You can't escape them. Somebody's calling you trying to sell you something, and many of those calls are not well-meaning. And so our number one complaint is those calls, especially when we're trying to, you know, hang out with our family or and we see this call. It looks like it's local, and it is not. So that's the number one irritant. For most people, a lot of people still talk about commercials on television in terms of how loud or not they are. We hear a lot of people complain about that. We have some jurisdictions when it comes to that. But a lot of what we do in terms of resources, in terms of the amount of money that we allocate that the American public helps us to support is your communications footprint when it comes to broadband and when it comes to you know, voice phone. We invest $8.6 billion annually of your money to support what we call a universal service program. And a lot of people might not be aware that over half of that fund goes to support something we call the Connect America Fund or the High Cost Fund. That means for those in rural America, that money is sort of an equalization of sorts. What I mean by that is if you live in a big city, it's going to cost per person much less to provide telephone service than it would if you live in Hollywood, South Carolina. You know, I had to bring up South Carolina because I'm a native. And so it's going to cost more to provide services in Hollywood, South Carolina. So with the FCC and Congress, what we have done was send some economic support to those carriers in the Hollywood, South Carolinas of the nation and saying this is the makeup, the economic makeup that you would get, you know, every month to support affordable services in those areas. Another thing that's gotten a lot of attention you know, when it comes to our universal service program is the schools and libraries program, or E-rate. Just about every school and library in this country has been the beneficiary of universal service, your dollars, to provide much needed connectivity to those centers for learning, those schools and those libraries, that those resource centers that are so important. So well over $3 billion, you know, goes to support that. We also have a healthcare connect fund that people don't know about. That is a much smaller pot, but about $300 or $400 million annually goes to support those small clinics in mostly in rural communities. giving them the connectivity they need to provide much needed service. And a program that I care a lot about that has been under attack for a number of years is the Lifeline program. You've heard about it. It has been negatively cast as the Obama phone. And I say that to say this program, the Lifeline program, has provided over 12 million people annually the only means of phone service that they could afford. There are a lot of people in this country that cannot afford basic phone service. There are even more who qualify for the service, but there is a stigma attached to it. But this program, if not for them, many of our neighbors, many of those persons when we travel that clean our rooms, that do domestic work, who are not high-wage people, they could not afford a phone but for this service. It has been under attack. I have been doing everything I can to make it more viable and to make it more, this is a word when I got up here that I learned, ubiquitous. And so that is very important for those who otherwise could not afford to dial 911, could not afford to call that employer back to keep that job, could not afford to find out what their children are doing in school. And so these are the things that people might not know that the FCC administers.
Yeah, and the Lifeline Assistance Program, I didn't know that that was a formal name for the Obama phones, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're eligible for those if you are already eligible for another state assistance, so like SNAP, Medicaid, Supplemental Security Income, Federal Public Housing,
absolutely.
And that this was a new initiative under the Obama administration. Is that correct?
Well, you know what? No. I hate to correct you on your show. But the Lifeline program has been around for 30 years. It started was established under the Reagan administration, was established just for what we call plain old phone service or landline phone service for those who could not afford it. It provided a monthly stipend to them, a supplement to them. It was expanded under the Bush administration for mobile or cellular service for those who could not afford it. And now what we have done is expanded it to offer a stipend or help for those who cannot afford broadband. And so it's been around for a while. You've just heard some of the negative press, which kind of brings it to play. But it's been around for a long time. And what we are attempting to do is to modernize it, to clean up some of the inefficiencies that I will admit that it suffered from. But this is a program that I believe that if we were to complement it or tie it to other initiatives that would help those in need, that we could have a connected country and people could do more. You and I both know with being connected and informed.
Yeah, I didn't know that it had been around for 30 years. Why do people call it the Obama phones then? Yeah, it is. It is literally like as old as it. Why do people call it the Obama phones?
Well, I think it is a negative political. There were some things that did happen that we did discover that people were abusing. There were some carriers that were doing some things that were not allowed. They were distributing, phones to people who did not qualify. But I want to assure people of this: if you do not qualify for the program, no matter who hands out anything, that company was not going to get a dime unless a qualified individual signed up for service. So you've got the optics. It was negative optics about people, intents and doing other things that were not allowed. Not everybody intents were all abusing, but there were some people who were mailing out phones to people who did not qualify. That made the news, and that really tarnished a program that is really seeking to help those in need. If you do not qualify for that program, if the company cannot prove that you qualify, you do not get a dime from the FCC or the administrators. So I want to assure people of that. But it got a negative stigma, and you know how politically intense things were back then. They still are. But people use politics and leverage. And unfortunately, the people who got trampled are the ones who need help the most. And that's the most unfortunate part of all of this, that the people who need this program, the program that we're doing our darndest to fit, that they caught up into this political vortex. And that's a shame. And we need to always continue to work against, those forces that will keep people from getting the help they need.
Yeah. And like you said, it started in 84, was expanded in 96, and it covers a monthly discount on landline or wireless telephone services. And importantly, and push me if I'm wrong here, is that it actually isn't subsidized wholly by taxpayer monies, but it comes out of the Universal Service Fund, which is a fee assessed against phone providers.
Absolutely. Is that correct? Well, and honestly, you as if you look at your bill, your next billing cycle, you will see a line item that says Universal Service Fund. We all contribute to the fund because we all know that everyone benefits when everybody's connected. The companies do contribute. Ultimately, you are paying the bill every month, and so that is how it's passed on to benefit everyone in America, particularly those who can't afford service or where the cost is too high to provide affordable service.
Now, I read recent comments of yours where you talk about net neutrality. Can you explain what the issue is with net neutrality? I know that phrase for some people doesn't resonate, or they just don't know. So what is it?
You know, to me, how I define it, and everybody defines net neutrality, I always say open internet, because to me, that better sums up what we're speaking about. We're speaking about the most empowering platform of our lifetime, and how we can ensure that everyone has access. If you have a gatekeeper, if you have a company, if you have a government that is blocking or extracting tolls, or is giving preference to me at the cost of you, then we don't benefit. So to me, when you talk about net neutrality, when you talk about open internet, it is having all legally flowing information, access to those things online that we could all benefit from, that it is equal, that is not discriminatory, that is open, that you can use any device of your choice if it's not harmful to the system to access the information, services, and people that will benefit you the most. So again, we're talking about an openness. We're talking about the First Amendment for connectivity when it comes to online service. That's how I describe, that's how I see net neutrality and the open internet. It is applying First Amendment principles to access online, to access to connectivity, to access, to the internet and broadband opportunities.
Like, what's the other side saying? So people who don't believe the internet should be open, what does that actually look like?
Well, they will say that that's not what they believe, but they think that that rules don't need to apply, that companies will abide by the principles, that there is no benefit for them to stifle innovation, to play favorites and the like. But we have seen example after example of where the big guys have slowed down traffic, have given preference, to other private providers. We have, exposed some of those, activities in terms of preferential treatment. So my thing is, the principles, the reason why you hear me talking about different titles, that they don't mean anything to the average people. But I say this, when it comes to this platform, there needs to be clear, laid out rules for all of us to govern ourselves. We have a responsibility as citizens to ensure that our conduct is legal and upstanding. And the companies have an obligation to be transparent about their rules, transparent and open when it comes to pricing and the like. And I think it's an important for us to have mutually inclusive rules of the road, so everyone knows how what is expected of the other. And so the argument is whether or not we need rules of the road for companies to conduct themselves accordingly. I have seen time and time again where big businesses answer to their shareholders and to their best interests, and too often I've seen consumers or individuals get the short end of the stick. This is too important a platform to leave that to chance, and that's why I'm supportive of Title II open internet principles with a strong referee, the FCC on the beat, being the persons that calls the shots, so everybody will benefit on the field.
And this means, and push me if I'm wrong here, I thought that net neutrality also meant that internet service providers would be able to charge more for faster service. So they could create these like express lanes for some people, which is different than how it currently functions today, where it's sort of like everybody's granted sort of equal access to the internet. Is that correct?
Well, I will say that a true open net neutral platform does not allow for principally what you just put out, that you cannot, if there is no reason to, charge anyone anymore, for a particular service that, or for access to the internet. You know, that's what we're talking about, what we call sort of the on-off ramps or access to the internet. In terms of your service plans or the like, that's something different. That's something that's transparent. Whatever you decide, if I want, 1 gigabit speed or if I want 10 gigabit speeds, chances are they're not going to cost the same. But my access to the internet, whether you're treating my traffic the same or my access the same, that is what we're speaking about, in principle.
And you were the first Black woman ever appointed to the FCC. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How do you think your identity has shaped your perspective or has helped you think about these issues differently, if at all?
I am very sensitive and conscious about, who I am and what I represent. African-American female voice has never been heard, on the eighth floor of the FCC in my particular, space in this office, in this title. I think that is important for everyone to see that inclusive, if you're more inclusive, that you get a better outcome, you get a better regulatory paradigm, that you get discussions that are more inclusive and expanded when it comes to perspectives. All of those things, I believe, when it comes to open internet principles, when it comes to Lifeline, when it comes to the Schools and Libraries Program or E-Rate, when it comes to one of the most important and challenging things that I think that we should be doing better when it comes to just and reasonable rates for inmates and their families when it comes to calls to and from prison. No one was speaking about that before I got here. No one was concentrating on that. We have been talking about, families have been attempting to get just and reasonable rates when it comes to calls that are made to and from prisons before 2000. No one gave voice to that before this commissioner got there. So these are the issues that are affecting 2.7 million children in our nation. There are 2.2 million or so inmates that are in prison. There are millions of individuals and families that are impacted. And no one was paying attention to this issue up until a few years ago. And so this is what I believe a different voice, a different face, brings to an agency. Perspectives and topics and things that are happening in the community that a regulatory fix, could improve. Those are the types of things that I think, in a broader sense, that were not happening on this floor. We call it the eighth floor. We're not happening on this floor in this commission before we got here.
Now, what can people do to influence the decisions of the FCC? Like, what would you say to people who are like, how can I make an impact? How can I influence the decision around net neutrality or around rates for prisoners, phone calls? Like, what can people do?
Every single decision that we make we have an open platform through the internet, through calls, through letters that people can weigh in. One of the things that I wanted to mention, that inmate calling a decision, because we just had a very negative finding from the court when we were in our attempts to really bring just and reasonable rates. If we did not hear from you and you care about this issue, you care about your neighbors and those children who cannot afford to speak to their parents, you should have been speaking up, but it's not too late. You should call the FCC and say you should do something about this problem. You should call your local sheriff. You should call your lawmakers back home. You should call Congress and say this is something that we care about. The FCC is ultimately responsible for 1/6 of our nation's economy, because that is what, when we talk about communications and telecommunications, that is the amount of gross national product that we're responsible for. The most important things in your life, how you communicate, when you communicate, how much you pay for communications, that is what the FCC is responsible for. And when it comes to this particular issue in terms of inmate calling, I say to you that the FCC has not been adequately following Section 1 of the Communications Act. And I want to read a part of that to you because I think it's important. The commission's purpose is to make available so far as possible to all the people of the United States, without discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or sex, a rapid, efficient, nationwide and worldwide wire and radio communication service with adequate facilities, and get this, at reasonable charges. When you see someone paying $1.50 a minute for a call, when you see someone not being able to afford broadband, when you see someone, you know, who cannot afford to be connected to their doctors, then we're not upholding that particular standard. So if we're not doing that, and if it's not benefiting you, you need to weigh in and say, this is what you should be doing. Why aren't you doing this? Here is this proceeding. So people need to speak up and speak out. This is your FCC. It's not the big business's FCC, but if we only hear from big business, if we only hear from industry, then I guarantee that the outcome is not going to be for the benefit of everyday citizens.
Got it. Well, that's helpful. I appreciate you joining me today on Pod Save the People. I consider you a friend of the pod, and I can't wait to see you back on the pod.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
And now my conversation with Lee Petro, one of the leading lawyers in the country, working on issues around increasing access to communication for the incarcerated. Here we go. Lee, it's an honor to have you on the pod today. Thanks so much for joining.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So Lee, how did this become your work?
You know, I started a couple of years ago starting to do work on a pro bono basis for those who are hard of hearing and need disability access to telecommunications. And then a friend of mine who I went to law school with said that, you know, there was this case dealing with inmates and the phone rates that were being charged. And it seemed, when I did a little bit of research, that it was just an egregious case of exploitation. So, you know, I took the case over in 2010 from the team that had set it up and had been working on it since, you know, 1999.
So, Lee, I thought payphones were in prisons and jails. Why are there no payphones? Like, how do we get to this even being an issue of the cost of calls in prison?
Sure. So, you know, up until really the early 1990s, the payphone industry was, you know, provided or ruled by the Bell companies. And so the Bell companies, or the local exchange carriers, you know, placed payphones at various locations, including jails and prisons. And their rates were subject to FCC regulation, you know, through the tariffing process. What began to happen in the late 1980s and early 1990s was this creation of the payphone calling card industry, where you could get a calling card from a different company. That company bought access on the payphone service and then resold the service to you, so you could dial around a payphone, you know, the Bell company, and, you know, use a calling card number. and get access. And so when that, or you know, when the technology was, you know, originated to permit that to happen, it really opened up the opportunity for other companies to provide the payphone service in prisons and jails. And as that developed, the actual Bell companies started to sell off their business to private companies that would, you know, enter into contracts with facilities and offer the service, you know, on a monopoly basis at that location.
That makes sense. So it seems like calling cards sort of cut into the profit margin of the payphone services or the payphone companies. Now, what about collect calling? I feel like I remember that most of the calls that I've ever taken from anybody in jail, at least years ago when my uncle was in jail, were collect. Is that not happening at the same rate that it was 10, 15 years ago?
No, it's completely dropped off. So, you know, as the calling card industry started and these private companies came into the local facilities and offered their services, they began to offer either prepaid or debit type account systems where you would either, you know, give them your credit card and they would just charge you for each call, or you would put a set dollar amount into your account and, you know, it'd be re-upped every time you burned through how much money you had deposited. So now we're looking at, you know, about 95% of calls from prisons and jails are either through prepaid or debit, and, you know, just 5% or less are collect call. And, you know, part of that is because collect calls had an issue of bad debt, so that the phone companies would be stuck with, you know, somebody would say, yes, I'll accept the call. They would ring up, you know, a $15, $20 bill, and then they wouldn't pay it. And so the companies would have to write it off. And it's certainly more efficient, if certainly if the rates are low enough, that, you know, a family member can budget, you know, we're going to budget $50 for calls from, you know, your father or your brother this month. And we've got to stay within that. And, you know, if the rates are low enough, you can actually have several conversations. You know, part of that process was the development of these ancillary charges, which, you know, is a whole separate matter. But, you know, the company started charging, you know, enormous amounts, $5, $10, $15, just to deposit money into your prepaid account or every time you did a credit card transaction.
So that makes sense. So just to recap, it looks like payphones weren't making money because of the calling cards, and then collect calls weren't making profit for the companies because people essentially just weren't paying the charges that they incurred. So what is the actual cost of a phone call from a jail or prison?
So the cost to provide the service for the company is less than 4 cents per minute. And that includes, you know, all of the security measures that they put over top, recording phone calls and such. The charge to the consumers can go anywhere between, you know, for interstate calls now, we're looking at caps at $3 and $3.75. But in some states and counties, the companies are charging up to $20 for a 15-minute phone call to the consumer. So, you know, the spread between 4 cents per minute and, you know, $20 for a 15-minute phone call, that's all profit for the phone companies.
Now, I thought I read somewhere that the phone companies are giving some of this money back to the actual jails and prisons. I didn't know that that was happening. Can you explain that?
Sure. It's one of the craziest parts of all of this. You know, it started, you know, really in the 90s when these private companies entered the market as an incentive to win the contract. They offered to share a portion of the profit with the correctional facility. And over the years, that percentage has grown, you know, from 5 or 10% to now some counties actually receive and states actually receive up to 90% of the revenue generated by phone calls. They actually get 90% of that back from the phone company. So every month, the phone company sends a report, a commission report to the jail, and they say, this is the amount of phone calls at your facility. this is your percentage, here's a check for, you know, 90% of it or 80% of it. So there's really no incentive for the prison or the jail to, you know, reduce the rates, because as the rates go down, they get less money back into their coffers.
So Lee, that's fascinating. I had never read or heard much about the prisons and jails profiting off of the calls, but I'm confused about how the phone companies can give away sort of 90% of the profits of the cost of calls and still make $1 billion or billions of dollars, as I've read that they do. Can you explain that to me?
Sure. You know, the first part of it, of course, is that it doesn't cost very much to provide that service. And then the second part of it, which is perhaps the most egregious aspect, are these ancillary fees that get tacked on to each phone call and all the other services that the providers offer at the jails. So, you know, I had mentioned previously that, you know, when you load money into your prepaid account, they charge you a fee. Up until recently, that fee was uncapped, and it was, you know, up to, you know, $10, $15 every time you wanted to load money into your prepaid or debit account. You would get charged a credit card fee of $10 or $15, and that was all pure profit. It was not part of the revenue that was shared with the prison or jail. It just went to the bottom line of the phone companies. The other aspect of this is that when they try to obtain the contract and they're going through the RFP process, they offer a number of additional services like email, music, tablets, educational programming, all of it. But of course, they charge the inmates and their families for those services. If you want to send an email, you buy a book of electronic stamps for $5. You know, it doesn't cost the company $5 to send an email, but you know, they pocket that revenue, and that offsets whatever they share through the commissions on the telephone calls.
And how are they able to keep 100% of that profit? Is any of that regulated by the FCC, or is only the calls regulated by the FCC?
Right. So, I mean, right now the FCC is not regulating anything other than phone calls and these ancillary fees, you know, the tack-on costs and such. So emails, tablets, video visitation, you know, all the other additional services that these providers offer at the jail or prison, you know, are outside of the FCC's jurisdiction right now. And really nobody, you know, no other government agency would have power. You know, perhaps the, you know, Consumer Protection or the FTC, but up until now, they declined to take a close look at it.
I've read recently about video conferencing. Is that expensive too, or is that cheaper than phone calls?
So they've, you know, the new movement is for the phone companies to offer video visitation so that, you know, family members can either have an app on their phone, or they go to the prison or some central location. Like in Virginia, some of the churches have video visitation booths set up so that you can, you know, speak with a family member who's in prison or jails. If you go to the prison, sometimes they'll put you in a room, and the room next to you is the inmate. You don't actually get to see them in person, but you talk to each other through a screen. Typically, the companies don't charge for on-site video visitation, but if you're at a remote site, you know, the fees are, you know, 50 cents or more per minute. So you pay $20 for a 15-minute video visitation session. The cost of providing, you know, the service is a bit more, but it's certainly not, you know, the different, or it's not certainly not 50 cents per minute to provide that service. And in most cases, the phone companies during the RFP process will say, we'll install this for free, but we get to keep all the revenue up until some certain dollar amount that's, you know, purportedly to cover their costs. So, you know, they bank 100% of that revenue for, you know, a good part of the contract. And then, you know, they'll share part of that revenue with the facility, you know, once they recoup their costs. So again, it's a question of, you know, the family members paying for this service dollar for dollar, and, you know, the facilities and the phone companies, you know, banking the, you know, the revenue.
That's fascinating. I had no clue that that they're willing to give up the profit on the actual calls on the front end because they're pocketing essentially 100% of everything else in the back end. What do you say to people who say that if the prisoners or inmates didn't want to pay the cost of making phone calls, and they just shouldn't have done the crime and they wouldn't be in jail anyway?
Well, you know, that ignores the fact that it's not the inmate that's actually paying the fee or the cost to remain in contact. It's the family member. It's the grandmother. Like in the case of, you know, my client, Martha Wright, you know, she was a blind 80-year-old woman whose grandson was in federal prison. And, you know, she had to decide between paying for her medication or remaining in contact with them. You know, overall, there's 50% of the folks that are incarcerated were once the primary breadwinner for their family. And, you know, 70% of the families that have somebody incarcerated have a child that's under 18. So you really aren't focused, or you really shouldn't be focusing on the inmate who's in the prison that's created this situation. It's really, you know, the family member, the wife, the grandmother that's, you know, footing the bill while their breadwinner is actually, you know, incarcerated, and they're trying to remain in contact so that when that person's released, they can, you know, resume being a member of society and not recidivate and go back to prison in the future.
Now, the FCC recently lost or got an unfavorable sort of decision from the courts. Can you give us like a brief explanation of what just happened?
Sure. So in October 2015, the FCC adopted a set of rates that would apply to all telephone calls between inmates and their families, both intrastate, you know, calls within the state, and interstate calls between states. You know, a large number of federal prisoners are kept, you know, 100 miles or more away and in other states from their family members. So interstate calls, you know, are important, but that's only about 20% of the overall call volume. The majority of the phone call volume are intrastate. And at the court, the FCC was originally defending the decision from October of 2015 to adopt a cap on the rates for calls within the state. Immediately after President Trump was took office and named the Chairman Pai as the leader of the FCC, they sent a letter to the court and said, we no longer agree with the prior FCC administration majority, and we are not going to be defending the assertion in the in the FCC order that said the FCC had the jurisdiction to regulate calls within states. And so essentially what they did was they backed away from defending the right of the FCC to regulate 80% of the call volume from prisons and jails. And the court took that into consideration. You know, the majority decision relied on that letter and said, if the FCC is not going to back it up, you know, why should we give them any deference for, you know, what was adopted in 2015?
So it seems like the court said that the FCC can only regulate calls that are made from inmates to another state, but the FCC doesn't have jurisdiction to regulate calls that are made in, like, within a single state. That's correct, right?
That's correct.
Yep. And so does that mean that the fight then needs to go to state legislatures? Is that what people should be working on to get their states to regulate the cost of calls within a state? And are any states doing that well?
Right. So there are a number of states that are doing it well. I mean, the fight really, I mean, it's not over at the FCC. The matter was remanded to the FCC and will, depending on how Chairman Pai decides to proceed, will, you know, determine whether there's anything we can do there. The other option is to go to Capitol Hill and try to get legislation passed in the past, or, you know, previously. Congressman Rush from Illinois, Representative Duckworth Senator Booker and Senator Sanders have all introduced resolutions or legislation in the past to give the FCC explicit authority to regulate intrastate call rates. And hopefully, you know, we can turn there. But there are a number of states that have acted on their own in recognition of this issue. New Mexico, Illinois, Alabama, New Jersey last year adopted, you know, a rate structure. So there are states that are moving forward. Overall, I would say that's less than, you know, 10 to 12 states that have actually capped the rates. Unfortunately, what we do is we face a situation where at the state level, the state public utility commissions have decided they're going to deregulate the telecommunication industry, which means that they ignore this subset of that telecom industry and, you know, don't set rates and don't regulate, you know, what happens to inmates and their families.
Is there anything that we don't know that you haven't talked about already that we should know? I feel like I'm still learning so much about the issue with the rates of prisoners or the rates of calls from prisoners. Is there anything we don't know?
Well, you know, quite honestly, I think what has to be, you know, really focused on is the consolidation within the industry and, the role that these companies play at the actual facility. These companies enter into a monopoly contract to be the sole provider of, you know, telecommunication services. These companies also own the commissary arms of the jails so that they dominate and, you know, have the ability to extract revenue, you know, for inmates who want to buy toothpaste or toothbrushes or, you know, new shoes, socks. And so essentially what's happened is, you know, the whole prison or jail services have been privatized. So these companies have become these one-stop shops. If they are, you know, in this case with intrastate rates, the FCC's power has been questioned. It's been overturned. They can easily shift to some other revenue stream because they dominate that particular facility. So, you know, what I would say is if folks are interested in this, what they really should be focusing on is the idea of, you know, should we be privatizing or commoditizing, you know, an inmate's stay in prison or jail? And, you know, what does that do to our society? Do we want to have private companies preying on inmates and their families that, you know, when they're at their weakest, most vulnerable moment and extract revenue from them for, you know, their own profit motive? That's really where I think, you know, this movement has to go, is to be focusing on, you know, just this massive consolidation. There's rumors that the largest company is now looking to buy the third largest company. So Global Tellink is negotiating to purchase the third largest company, Telmate, which would further consolidate the market. In my mind, what we really have to look at is just this enormous, you know, exploitation of, you know, people at their most vulnerable state.
And, you know, that's a fascinating point about, we talk a lot about private prisons, and what we don't talk a lot about is the privatization of services in public prisons. And that is what's happening here. So appreciate you coming on the pod. Consider you a friend of the pod. Look forward to having you back so we can dig deeper into this issue. Thank you so much, Lee.
My pleasure. And I appreciate you taking a look into it. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the People, and make sure that you rate it wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And make sure that you tell a friend. See you next week.